Jeffrey, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
How important is Apollo 8 to the space race, that mission, and more specifically to fulfilling President Kennedy's promise to put a man on the moon by the end of the 1960s?
Well, it was central to that. There were a couple of things that I think are worth remembering. First is that human beings had never been away from the gravity field of Earth before. We'd been to space. America itself had flown 16 missions in the Apollo and in the Mercury and Gemini programs, but they had all been in low Earth orbit. That's a little like dog paddling in your own harbor. Apollo 8 was the first time we sailed out of the harbor, went across the ocean, and surrendered to the gravity field of another world. We became a two-planet species or a two-world species instead of a one-world species then. In terms of achieving President Kennedy's goals, that was critical to getting us to a position where we could close that final 60 miles and descend to the lunar surface. But it was also critical in terms of the tick-tock of the calendar, because Apollo 8 was planned. The decision was made in the summer of 1968 when there were only 16 months left in the deadline, in the target date to get people to the moon by the end of 1969. We had originally been on target to meet that goal, but at the beginning of 1967, three astronauts died on the launch pad in the Apollo 1 fire, and the entire program came to a halt. So in order to meet Kennedy's goal, everything had to be kickstarted, everything had to be compressed, and everything had to be turbocharged. And it began with that decision in the summer of 1968 to throw out the existing flight schedule, to fix the problems in the Apollo spacecraft and in the Saturn V rocket, to give the people building a lunar lander another few months, and to get three guys out to the moon just 4 months later, to get them into lunar orbit, to make them the first human beings to reach the moon, and to do it on Christmas Eve. And they succeeded in doing that.
Who was the crew for Apollo 8?
The crew was Jim Lovell, Frank Borman, and Bill Anders. And they were a crew uniquely equipped for this mission in a lot of ways. Not insignificantly, because Borman and Lovell had flown together once before on Gemini 7, and that was a thankless mission. Nobody had wanted it. It was 2 weeks in space with nothing really to do except orbit the Earth and fly that endurance test. They liked to say at the time they didn't so much conduct the experiments. They were the experiment. The spacecraft was tiny. Picture sitting in two coach seats of an airplane without moving, without getting out of those seats for 2 weeks, with the overhead baggage bin just 3 inches above your head. That's what these guys dealt with. So if they could work together well, then they surely would work together in the Apollo spacecraft. Bill Anders was a rookie, younger, fresher, a little more exuberant, a little less seasoned, and exactly the kind of fresh, young ingredient they needed in that mission. Borman also was, they were all patriots, but Borman had signed on hoping to fight for his country in the Korean War. He hadn't gotten the shot to do that, and this was a battle in the Cold War, and he was determined to fly this mission and win that battle for his country.
How risky a mission was Apollo 8?
It was exceedingly risky, although the astronauts tried not to think about that too much. When I was writing Apollo 13 with Jim Lovell, I once asked him, when you were on the night before all of your missions, did you ever look around your living room and think, well, gee, if this mission doesn't go well, I'm never going to see this lovely home again? And he kind of laughed and he said, no, if you thought that way, you wouldn't go. And all three men took that attitude into Apollo 8 as well. They did know, though, that they were flying a uniquely risky mission. Lovell didn't really consider the odds. He was never quite so happy as when he was in space, and never so happy in space as when he was doing something outrageous like flying to the moon. So he didn't really think of the odds. Borman tried not to either, but his wife Susan, who was and remains a very tough and very frank woman, She was determined to find out, so she cornered Chris Kraft, who was the director of flight operations, not long before the crew left. And she said, "Chris, what are their odds? And what are the odds that they're going to come home?" And he said, "You really want to know that, don't you?" And she said, "Yes, and you know I do." And he answered her equally honestly. He said, "All right, well, how's 50-50? Bill Anders had a slightly more optimistic and slightly more nuanced view. He thought their odds were 33-33-33. A 33% chance they were going to completely succeed in their mission, a 33% chance they were not going to orbit the moon, but that they would survive, and a 33% chance that they were going to die in the effort. Mm. But they were all willing to take that shot.
Was this the first mission where the Saturn V rocket was used?
It was the first, crewed mission. I don't mean crewed, C-R-U-D-E.
First mission that had a crew. Okay.
Yeah, the first mission that had a crew. The Saturn V had flown twice before unmanned. The Apollo 4 mission was brilliant. It did exactly what it was supposed to do. They were thrilled with this rocket. They set it up again on the Apollo 6 mission, a slightly more ambitious, also unmanned mission. And on that mission, the Saturn V did every single thing wrong. It practically shook itself to pieces getting to orbit, and had astronauts been aboard, they may well have been killed by the vibrations. When that mission was over, Chris Kraft, who was just as honest and candid and blunt as Susan Borman, issued a statement to the press, and he said, "This flight was a complete disaster, and I insist you use that word. It was a disaster." The very next time that rocket flew, three astronauts were on top of it.
Wow. This is the mission that produced that beautiful, iconic Earthrise photo. Can you talk about the significance of that photo?
Yeah, that was pretty remarkable. I mean, we've seen that photo. It's been reproduced hundreds of millions, even billions of times. It happened on the third orbit of the moon. The spacecraft had been positioned in such a way that the astronauts could see the lunar surface and they could see a little bit of space around it, but they hadn't lifted the nose up enough that they could see the Earth rising above the moon. It was on the third rotation that they got their first glimpse of it, and you hear Frank Borman in the cockpit recording tapes say, "Oh, look at this. There's the Earth. That's so beautiful." And that's what, I mean, these guys were, you know, they were just given to exclaiming what they were seeing. Anders was the mission photographer, and all he had was black and white film in his camera. So he began shouting to Lovell, "Get me some film, get me some film, get me something color." Lovell dives into the lower equipment bay, picks up the first color canister he sees, reads off the speed of the film, and says, "Is this correct?" And Anders says, "Anything, anything at all, as long as it's color." Lovell shoots back out. They slam that film magazine into the camera, and in that moment, they lost the shot. The moon drifted away. A second later, however, Borman caught it out of another window and said, "It's here. I've got it out of window 5. And Anders darted over there and fired off multiple shots. And you hear in the background both Borman and Lovell saying, "Get a lot of them, take a lot of them." And he did take a lot of them. And nobody knew at that moment, since there was no way in those days of, you know, previewing something on the screen of a digital camera, this was traditional film, there was no way of knowing what was resting in his camera, and they didn't know it until they got back to Earth, and that film was hand-carried into a lab. The picture produced was the one that is widely credited with turbocharging the environmental movement, because for the first time we saw how beautiful and breakable the Earth is floating in space.
Jeffrey, how did that historic Christmas Eve reading of Genesis while the astronauts were orbiting the moon, how did that come to be?
That was an interesting bit of history. NASA knew that during the broadcast from space, the astronauts were probably going to have TV audiences numbering in the hundreds of millions. But they also knew that the one that was going to happen on Christmas Eve, December 24th, around 9 p.m. East Coast time, that would probably have a worldwide audience of about 1 billion people. Well, there were only 3.5 billion people in the world in the world at the time, about half what there are today, which meant close to one out of every three people on the planet were going to watch this broadcast. Julian Scheer, the chief public affairs officer of NASA, told the Apollo 8 astronauts, look, you're going to have the biggest audience in history watching what you're doing. Think of something appropriate. Well, again, these guys were pilots, not poets. You know, they think of something appropriate. I wouldn't know of what to say in a moment like that. So the assignment went to a man named Joe Layden, who was the head of the American Information Agency, basically America's PR department. And he was assigned the job of coming up with something. Even he was stumped. And it was about 4 in the morning that his wife came into the kitchen where he was working on this, and she said, Genesis. Have them read from Genesis. And he knew that he had his answer. They typed up Genesis on fireproof paper because there would be no, after the Apollo 1 fire killed those three astronauts in 1967, there was nothing flammable in a spacecraft. The script was put in the back of the flight plan, and the astronauts held it till Christmas Eve. It was a magnificent moment. It was just the right words on just the right mission in just the right year.
Now, what was the mistake that Jim Lovell made on Apollo 8 that ended up playing a really crucial part in saving the Apollo 13 crew?
It was actually a fascinating bit of historical serendipity. They were flying back from the moon, and they were all fatigued. I mean, they had flown for 6 days and had almost no sleep. And Jim inadvertently punched a bad command into the computer. He essentially told the spacecraft it was back on the launch pad in Florida. Well, when you're on the launch pad in Florida, you don't need your guidance system to be operating because you know where you are. You're on the ground. So the spacecraft effectively erased its own memory of where it was in space. Now, as far as the computer was concerned, they were lost in space. Well, there was a way to get it back, to get that guidance system back, but Lovell had to figure it out on the fly. And what he realized was he had to navigate like the ancient mariners did. So he took initial rough sightings on the Earth, the sun, and the moon, and then took finer and finer sightings on star after star after star until the spacecraft knew exactly where it was again in the three-dimensional bowl of space. And when he was done, it took him about half an hour, he realized, this is a good technique for a future commander to have in his back pocket in case any catastrophic accident in the future ever wipes out his computer's memory. Well, guess what? 16 months later, Lovell's in command of Apollo 13, and a catastrophic accident wiped out his computer's memory. He was a man uniquely in a position to solve that problem.
You know, the space race captured the imagination of so many people, and it enthralled so many of us. I can remember as a kid being glued to the news coverage on TV. I'm just wondering, do you think we ever reach a point where we see something like that again that just captures us like this did?
I think it's possible. It is tragic that we lost that excitement, that we lost that vision. Now, I think part of it is human nature. You know, we had been in this flat-out foot race with the Soviets for 9 years, and then come the summer of 1969, we won. Okay, well, we're human. People wanted to do the touchdown dance and be done with it. But, of course, that didn't mean that landing on the moon had gotten any easier. It just proved that it was something we could do. Now it was time to build on it. But the national will sort of flagged after that, and certainly the willingness to spend the money flagged, and we came to take space for granted. But I think if you focus the country again, if you told Americans, guess what, we're going to be back on the moon 4 summers from right now in 2021, I think you would have exactly that kind of crystallized focus again. Certainly if you told Americans, and after that, we're going to be on Mars by a hard target, say 2027. I think people would be equally committed to that goal. You see it now, even with robot spacecraft. Look in the summer of 2012 when the Curiosity rover landed on Mars. There were swarms in Times Square watching it live on the jumbotrons. There were sleepover parties in science museums all over the country while people watched it. NASA's and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's websites crashed from people live streaming this, and that was just a robot. The fascination with space hasn't changed. Our commitment to going is what's different. And I think if we choose to go again, as President Kennedy put it, it's a very powerful verb, if we choose to go again, I think we will also reawaken that questing spirit in Americans.
Jeffrey, thanks for joining me today.